You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. On this episode, we're going to have an interview with Charles Campbell from the Dogwood Initiative about their Slick Loonies campaign.
One of the things that we really wanted to do with the Loonie campaign was give a voice to all those people throughout BC who feel strongly that, you know, we don't want an oil spill, and the time to stop it is now, not after a spill happens.
And we'll have an interview with Douglas Nakashimo from UNESCO, United Nations Group, interested in local communities and climate change.
At the international level, it's quite important to develop a set of observations and understandings of experiences of indigenous communities with climate change, something that can, let's say, in some ways offset or provide a counterbalance to all of the scientific work that's been ongoing. Because the observations at the very local community level are extremely important for any strategy relating to adaptation.
I am Ryan Fletcher, and welcome to Sustainable Futures. So that intro song that we always use is I'm a Mountain by Moira Campbell. This episode of Sustainable Futures is going to be an important one, especially if you're from the BC area. We have today a provincial interview and an international interview, but the provincial issue is one that could very well become one of international importance. And this is an interview with Charles Campbell of the Dogwood Initiative, talking about this upcoming attempt to bring oil from the Alberta tar sands to the BC coast to then ship it to Asia. So this is a big project that is going to be getting pushed our way in the future. So the interview is about first the Dogwood Initiative and what they do, and then their Slick Loonies campaign, which is about this issue of the tankers on the west coast and these pipelines. So I personally think this is a very important issue and one that's going to be a very, very big issue in the future, at least provincially, and probably even more than that. So peel your ears into this one. I think you're going to hear a lot about this in the coming years. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Charles Campbell, and we're talking about the Slick Loonie Initiative. And Charles is with the Dogwood Initiative. First of all, what is the Dogwood Initiative?
So we're a BC-based nonprofit. We work with communities and First Nations in BC really to make sure that they gain and maintain control of their land and resources in British Columbia with an eye to developing them sustainably.
So this is right across BC?
Yeah, we work right across BC.
So all First Nations groups?
We work in a targeted manner, so at various times we have different campaigns working with different First Nations groups.
Okay.
As well as communities.
And what about the name, the Dogwood?
Dogwood, we chose that name because Dogwood is BC's provincial flower and initiative, because we like to take the initiative and, yeah, make sure things move forward.
Right. Yes. Also, I'm going to be talking about your Slick Loonie Initiative. Please tell me what this is.
So this is part of our campaign to prevent a catastrophic oil spill in BC's inside coastal waters. what we've done is we've taken some little decals which go over the bird and the water on a loonie and color them black to replicate an oil spill. And it directs people to our website, which is notankers.ca, where they can find out more about the threats to BC's coast from oil spills.
How does it direct people? Is there the website written on the loonie itself somehow?
Yes, it directs people to notankers.ca, which is printed on the loonie decal. So people can go there and they can sign a petition to keep oil tankers away from BC's inside coastal waters. They can also register their loonie sighting. So we've got...
Neat. That's neat. Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got a little Google map up there where you can see where these loonies have been spotted across the country. So we have loonies spotted from Whitehorse right across to Nova Scotia. People have been seeing these deckled loonies, and we've been getting a lot of interest for the campaign.
It must be written really small to go onto a loonie.
It's legible. Yeah. Have you seen them yet?
I've not seen one yet, no.
Oh, you haven't seen one yet. Okay, well, you can go on to notankers.ca website, and if you log on, you'll get an image of what the loonie looks like. And so, yeah, the decal, it just covers the bird and the water black. And really, it's something that we're using to help our supporters show their support for a tanker ban on BC's coast. So we've printed out these decals, and people are going online and ordering sheets of decals for themselves and decaling their coins. We're also distributing them to businesses,
great,
and through student groups and so on. And we've got about... We're coming up to close to 400,000 decals in distribution.
Wow. So it's actually the citizen himself that does the decaling?
That's right, yeah. We help, or we've organized a few parties with volunteers who've put a few thousand decals on, but the bulk of those 400,000 decals have gone out through citizens across the country, primarily in BC, who really have been interested in keeping a tanker ban. So really, we were looking for a way that people could show their support for the campaign and voice their concerns about an oil spill on BC's coast. And this is a fairly simple, easy-to-do act. All you have to do is go online and order the decals at notankers.ca. $10 will get you 42 decals, and you decal your coins and put them into distribution. And as we say, we're coming up to 400,000 decals in circulation now. So.
Okay. And I'm not familiar with the term decal. I guess I'm not an artist. Artists probably would recognize the term, probably. But what exactly is...
We would call it a sticker, except it doesn't have any adhesive on the back. So it's just like a little clear plastic sticker which goes onto the loonie, but it adheres with static cling instead of with glue.
Static?
Yeah. So if you have ever bought a pair of sunglasses and you see that little sticker on the front,
yep,
which is UV protected, and you take it off and there's actually no adhesive to gum up your sunglasses, it's the same technology. So it's a temporary decal. We're very careful to avoid defacing currency.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. So if you are concerned about that, it's completely temporary, but... Fortunately, they do seem, they're quite durable. They'll stick around in your pockets. We haven't had many falling off, so.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is it just loonies, or are there any other coins you can
work with? It's really
targeted
at loonies. I've seen a few people stick them on toonies and quarters even. They'll just about fit on a quarter, but obviously it's made to go on a loonie with the bird and it covers the bird and the water exactly, so.
Mm-hmm.
We figured it's really a great way to make that connection between oil and money in Canada, and giving people a way to let money talk for them instead of talk for the oil industry.
Nice. So maybe you can give us some background on the issue now. What's happening with oil, like tankers coming off the coast?
Well, the main issue is a project that they're proposing to ship up to 525,000 barrels of oil a day from the tar sands to Asia via an oil tanker port in Kitimat on the coast of BC.
Mm-hmm.
that amounts to almost half the total production of the Alberta oil sands. So we're looking at a lot of oil here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously where there is oil being transported, there is oil being spilled. And that, of course, is our main concern. So we're looking at 1,200-kilometer pipeline route mm-hmm. from the tar sands to Kitimat, and then we're looking at a tanker port in Kitimat and up to 225 tankers a year traveling to that port to ship oil out to Asia.
Mm-hmm. They must be pretty big tankers.
Yeah, we're looking at super tankers. These are some of the largest tankers in the world.
Uh-huh.
At that volume, you know, we're looking at 525,000 barrels of oil a day being
uh-huh.
shipped out of that port. So that amounts to, you know, 2 to 3 tankers a week.
Mm-hmm.
Super tankers have never been in BC's waters before. There are some tankers going through the port in Vancouver, but they're much, much smaller, and super tankers present some unique risks because of their size and the
mm-hmm.
difficulty to maneuver them,
mm-hmm.
especially in waters as treacherous as the waters of northern BC.
Right. So is Kitimat on the north coast? Where exactly is Kitimat?
Kitimat's on the north coast of BC. It's, if you go up past Vancouver Island, almost all the way up to Prince Rupert, there is a narrow fjord that crosses the Inside Passage. And if you follow that fjord about 140 kilometers up, that fjord is the port of Kitimat.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that in a lot of those areas around the Queen Charlotte's or going north, there tends to be a lot of debate about what country you're in or who's in charge there. Has that been part of the issue?
The transportation in this area is under federal jurisdiction, so
mm-hmm.
there isn't really any question about which jurisdiction it is. There would be some concerns about who was responsible for cleaning up the oil.
Uh-huh.
The company that's proposing the tanker port says their responsibility ends at the tanker port, and as we know with spills such as the Exxon Valdez, it's often the local communities and the taxpayer who ends up footing the bill
mm-hmm.
for cleanup of a spill.
What is the stages of this plan right now? Is this something that's already being built, or is this something that's on the table?
It's on the table. They're getting ready to go through the regulatory process. So we're very keen to get people to show their opposition to the project
uh-huh.
right now, because the more money they spend on this project, obviously, the more likely it is to go through. So really, now is a time to prevent an oil spill on BC's coast by people showing their opposition to the project.
What is the situation in Alberta right now? Has there been a lot of spills, and how are things going there? Are things going full bore, or how are things?
Well, production of the tar sands is slowing down slightly with economic downturn,
uh-huh.
but they do anticipate that it will eventually ramp up again. And really, this pipeline is being built to facilitate further expansion of the Alberta tar sands. I mean, we do have spills along pipelines all the time. The company that is building this pipeline, Enbridge, or proposes to build this pipeline,
Enbridge.
Last year, they had some major oil spills in Wisconsin, for example. They were sued by the Wisconsin government, ended up settling out of court for $1.1 million for their environmental infractions. So we do see problems along the pipeline route as well as with tanker spills.
Yeah. That's not surprising that it's a real big player like Enbridge involved, considering it's the Alberta tar sands.
Yeah. They're Canada's largest pipeline company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what are some rivers on this proposed route that are going to be threatened by this?
The two that everyone will know are the Fraser and the Skeena. So BC's largest two salmon rivers, it goes through the headwaters of both of those, the pipeline route. So obviously if we were to have a spill along the pipeline route that would affect one of those rivers, we could be looking at devastating impacts to our salmon.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your slick loony now. What does a person need to do if they want to do this? They order it. Where would they order it from?
So if you go to notankers.com www.cj.ca and click on the link at the bottom of the page that says Order Decals. You'll be taken to a page where you can order decals for as little as $10 for 42 decals. Mm-hmm. And they'll arrive in the mail about a week later for you, and you can stick them on your coin. And yeah, as I say, we've got significant uptake now. So we've also got a lot of local businesses have gotten involved and are giving out some of the decals for free. If you buy a bar of Denman Island chocolates, for example, you'll often find a little strip of three loony decals included in the bar of chocolates.
Mm-hmm. Neat. I was trying to think of how I could get involved myself, because I actually save my loonies and put them in little wrapper things. But I guess a person could also just go to a local business and offer to do some for them.
Yeah, well, what...
Those would go into currency right away.
What some people have been doing, they go to the bank, they take out a roll of loonies, and they decal the loonies, they roll them back up again, and then they take them to a local business and say, hey, you know, give me $25, and you can put these in your till as change, and we'll get these out into circulation more quickly. Other people are just decaling loonies as they come into their house and, you know, spending them on their cup of coffee in the morning or whatever. So the amount that people do will vary from person to person and place to place. Other people have ordered hundreds of decals and organized parties with their friends to come over and put the stickers on and then go away and put those all into circulation.
Is it one decal per loony?
It's one decal per loony, yes.
One per loony? Yep. Okay.
They're pretty simple to put on. Okay. We've done I think our record now is to do a roll of loonies in about 3 minutes. It takes to do 25 loonies.
Okay.
So,
how long has this been going?
We started the campaign back in February. It's had an interesting trajectory. We started the campaign in February, and the next day we got a call from the Royal Canadian Mint demanding that we cease and desist.
Yeah.
Threatening to take us to court. They said that we were using currency for purposes other than as currency.
Mm-hmm.
We got some legal advice and essentially called their bluff. The law that they had quoted actually pertains to the melting of coins, not really not using coins for things in addition to currency. So we feel we were on the right side of the law, and we've kept the campaign going, and the Mint has stayed quiet since their initial contact with us back in February. So we kind of feel silence is consent in this case.
Now, is the law the defacing of currency?
There is a law against the defacing of currency, which is a criminal offense. There's also a law under the Currency Act against, it's subtitled the melting of coins. Basically, it disallows you from taking coins and melting them down and using them for jewelry or purposes other than as currency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the law that they said that we were in breach of.
Well, that's interesting. I would have thought they would have gone for the other one.
Well, as I said, we were very careful to make sure the loonies were, the decals were temporary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, we didn't feel there was much threat of being prosecuted under defacing currency. As it turns out, they haven't actually prosecuted anybody under that law, and we thought it was really unlikely that we would be the first, especially when we're just putting a temporary decal on the coin.
Okay. With the oil tankers, is there any other things being organized around this scary development?
There are all sorts of other things being organized. I mean, communities up and down the coast are organizing themselves. A group up north called Friends of Wild Salmon has called for a public inquiry to assess the full and cumulative impacts of the proposal. First Nations are up and down the coast have stated their opposition to oil tankers. There are, you know, since we've started the campaign, we've had people come forward and they're doing presentations to local yacht clubs. Their kayaking groups and surfing groups and so on are getting on board and offering their support to the campaign. Really, we're seeing a huge groundswell of activity on this campaign. And I'd say one of the things that we really wanted to do with the Loonie the Looney campaign was give a voice to all those people throughout BC who feel strongly that, you know, we don't want an oil spill, and the time to stop it is now. It's not after a spill happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could foresee this getting to be pretty big, because with all of that the government's been investing in these oil sands, despite all of the opposition worldwide, and now I can't see them stopping their trade to China and then still going on with the oil tankers. That must be pretty crucial for them.
The producers in Alberta have large appetite for a port, for a Western port, to ship significant quantities of oil to Asia, with not only because they're accessing a new market, but also because it would be giving them leverage against new environmental regulations in the States. So President Obama has stated pretty clearly that dirty oil really isn't welcome in the States. And the tar sands, with its significant environmental impacts and impacts much greater than conventional oil, really they're quite concerned about this. And instead of cleaning up their act, they're really looking for a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card. Mm-hmm. And that, for them, is the oil port on Canada's west coast.
Mm-hmm.
So what one of the objectives of this campaign is to not allow them to do that, to, you know, if Canada is going to continue to produce oil from the tar sands, then they have to clean up their act. Really, the global warming causes the gases that the tar sands produce and the amount of water that they pollute and the air pollution that they cause and the energy that goes into the production of tar sands oil. They really have to look at all of these things and begin to clean up their act rather than looking for a way out of acting responsibly.
Has there been any international interest in this?
Yes, there has been a lot of interest from the States, I think partially because of the concern over global warming and that the tar sands really, you know, are such a bad player in this, and they're really holding Canada's entire energy policy hostage. They're trying very hard to paint their project as green. If you go onto their website, their tagline is caring for the environment, and they're trying very hard to greenwash this project and make it look community-friendly. But the fact is that they're very unwilling to assume any real liability if there is an oil spill, and ultimately it's going to be communities up and down the coast that are left cleaning up the mess.
You're listening to an interview with Charles Campbell of the Dogwood Initiative, talking about their Slick Loonies campaign on sustainable futures, CJSF 90.1 FM. There was a pretty good article in the National Geographic about what's going on in the tar sands. You're probably familiar with that.
Yeah.
What are some things that have been happening over there? Maybe you could tell us some of the things that the oil has been doing.
Well, if you look at the impacts of the tar sands, you know, when it takes them, they have to dig out about 2 tons of earth for every barrel of oil. They pollute 2 barrels of water for every barrel of oil. The amount of waste from the tar sand is phenomenal. And with that waste and that pollution comes significant impacts to human health for people like the First Nations living in Fort Chipewyan, who are downstream from the tar sands. I mean, really, it's one of the world's largest ecological disasters, sadly, and it's in our own backyard. I think for a lot of Canadians, it's out of sight and out of mind, and obviously there is money to be made up in Alberta, so people seem to be willing to turn a blind eye, but we really feel that the tar sands should be paying the real cost of their oil production, which both in terms of the environment and in terms of human health. And once they start paying the real cost of that, then it might not be quite so economic to continue exploiting that resource in the way it's being exploited.
Are there any deadlines upcoming now with the planning of this pipeline going to Kitimat?
Well, we are anticipating that Enbridge will be submitting their application for regulatory approval in the next couple of months, likely in June, but maybe shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And after that happens, there begins a process of community consultation, as they call it. One of our concerns about the Canadian environmental assessment process is that they actually almost never turn down a project. They will suggest things that can be done possibly to mitigate some of the damage that might be caused by a project,
mm-hmm.
but they very rarely turn it down to the extent, I think, about 99% of all projects that go through the Canadian Environmental Assessment Review are approved. So really the time to for people to voice their concerns is now, and it's only with really strong community opposition that we're going to manage to defeat this project. I should point out that projects like this have come forward in BC before. Back in the 70s, there was another proposal for an oil port at Kitimat, this time to bring in oil from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And the community there stood up and said no, and that project was shut down. Unfortunately, we can't rely on the government and the Canadian environmental assessment process to take care of our community interests in this case, and really it's up to communities to take care of their own interests. So that's why we're really working hard to rally support for a ban on tankers on BC's north coast.
Mm-hmm. So the call is for a ban on tankers?
The call is for a ban on tankers in BC's inside coastal waters.
Okay. This environmental assessment group, where do they draw their assessors? What kind of people are looking at these things, are reviewing these proposals?
It's called a joint panel review. So there are people both from the National Energy Board
mm-hmm.
and from Canadian Environmental Assessment. And so it has kind of two funny arms. The National Energy Board people are generally keen on seeing, you know, Canada's resources exploited to the greatest extent possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll be people on the environmental assessment side who are concerned with mitigating the damage done by that exploitation. That's basically the rough configuration. Unfortunately, there is unlikely to be anybody who will be really looking at if we should have this project rather than how we should have it. They see their job as determining how it goes ahead, not if it goes ahead. So again, it's really up to communities to state that if we want it. And we've done a lot of polling for citizens in BC and found that about 75% of British Columbians oppose oil tankers
mm-hmm.
on BC's inside coastal waters.
Good.
But of course, those people, it's only if they're willing to show their power politically and to stand up to the government and to these companies that we're going to get any movement on this.
Okay. Well, I'll have those listeners getting their loonies on the go. I think this is really fun.
Okay, yeah. Again, you can go on to notankers.ca and
yeah.
order your decals. You can also sign a petition to keep BC's coast oil tanker free, and you can register your loony sightings. And if you want to get more involved, send us an email.
Yeah, okay.
You can send me something at charles@dogwoodinitiative.org, and we'll get you hooked up with the campaign. And, I mean, really, we rely almost solely on people power. Enbridge has $100 million to spend
yeah.
on their PR machine to move this forward. We don't have budgets like that, but we have
yeah.
the commitment of people up and down the coast. So really, we invite students and whoever else to join the campaign and get on board.
All right. That sounds great. It's a very interesting issue for sure. I think people can rally behind this. I think there's a lot of really important, you know, movements that are coming together on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's important both in terms of local impacts with oil tankers and oil spills, and from global impacts with the effect of climate change that the tar sands is causing. So, on every level,
yeah.
the idea of oil tankers in BC's water is a bad idea. It's not just we're not just being NIMBYs. We're actually considering the greater good, and really the greater good is served by stopping tankers.
Okay. Well, before we close off here, I want to go back to the initial beginning of the conversation, which is Dogwood Initiative's initiative with Aboriginal groups. How do Aboriginals fit into all of this?
They have a really crucial role to play in this. The pipeline crosses the territory of, I believe, about 60 First Nations, and a lot of those have never ceded their territory through the treaty process.
Yeah.
So they have a significant say on what is going to happen with this project.
Yeah.
As I say, Enbridge is spending upwards of $100 million on getting this pipeline approved, and that a lot of that money is being dedicated to convincing First Nations that they should join in. We've already seen a lot of First Nations stand up and say no, particularly the larger and more sophisticated First Nations across BC are really beginning to show their opposition to this project because it will have significant impacts on their traditional territories.
Well, I feel it can be done, and I'm really excited for this project, and thank you.
We think we can win. As I say, we don't have $100 million to spend, but we do have the people of BC behind us, and you know, First Nations are a significant part of that too, because they are showing their opposition to the project, and really the thing with the pipeline, if you can stop one inch of it, you can stop the whole thing. It only works if they can get it approved across the entire stretch of pipeline, and we think we can stop more than an inch, so...
Well, this is really great. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we close out here?
I think we've just about covered it.
So this has been Ryan Fletcher interviewing Charles Campbell of Dogwood Initiative. We're talking about the Slick Loony Initiative and oil tankers off the coast of BC. So thank you very much for spending time with us on Sustainable Futures, Charles.
All right, no problem. Thanks a lot for calling me.
Now, the next interview on the program is with Douglas Nakashimo of UNESCO, and he spoke about global warming. He had some interesting information on how things sort of work at the United Nations, as well as what their thinking is. I like this interview in that it's a comparison of the knowledge of scientists and that of Aboriginals in their respective regions. Sometimes I believe our society becomes too focused on expertise and expertism, and who we do label expert tends to be biased in many cases. I like how the Aboriginal local community indigenous perspective is being looked at in this UNESCO project. So here's the interview with Douglas Nakashimo of UNESCO. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher from Sustainable Futures, and I'm interviewing Douglas Nakashimo of UNESCO's Frontlines of Climate Change Forum. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Glad to be part of it.
First of all, what is UNESCO?
UNESCO is a United Nations specialized agency, and its specific mandate relates to the issues of education, natural sciences and social sciences, but also culture and communication and information. So it's a very large organization that deals with all those specific areas that relate to, let's say, the more intellectual component of the UN family's responsibilities.
Okay. And then getting more specific, what is the Frontlines of Climate Change Forum?
Within UNESCO's current program, there is a smaller sub-program that relates to local and indigenous knowledge systems called the LINCS program.
Mm-hmm.
We've developed an internet-based forum that's looking at the challenges relating to climate change for indigenous peoples and communities from vulnerable environments such as small islands, circumpolar north, and mm-hmm. these other areas.
What are some unique issues with indigenous peoples for climate change?
I think the whole climate change issue, of course, is very prominent internationally now. Everyone's talking about climate change, but one of the challenges in particular for local communities or indigenous peoples is getting their voice heard in these international debates. Up until now, of course, the debates have been very scientific. I mean, over the last many years, the focus has been on issues like, is climate change really happening? And, you know, what does it mean? There's been a lot of investment, say, in the hard science side of climate change. But in the last couple of years, of course, with the fact of accepting that climate change is a reality that we need to deal with, the focus has shifted towards issues of adaptation. That is, how do people on the ground adapt their lives to the changes that climate change is going to bring?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the issue comes in being very important for indigenous peoples, for local communities, in terms of facing the challenges of adapting to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say indigenous peoples, maybe could you give us an idea of what kinds of populations that is dealing with? Are these people that are sort of marginalized people native to their homeland, or what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, that is always a challenging issue in itself within the UN context. Of course, in the Canadian context, there are various terms that are used, Aboriginal peoples, Native peoples, and it's quite understood, let's say, within the Canadian context. But in the global context, we are talking about peoples who have extended attachment to the land, whose livelihoods, for the most part, are linked to still linked to living off the land in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there are also many indigenous peoples who are living now in urban settings. And, of course, the situation for indigenous peoples, let's say, in Asia or in Africa can be quite different from that of Aboriginal peoples in Canada. So there's quite a wide range that is covered by this term of indigenous peoples. But I suppose within the UN context, an important reference point is now those peoples who declare themselves to be indigenous and see themselves represented by the UN permanent form of indigenous issues that is now established in New York, UN New York.
Mm-hmm. What are some things that are discussed in reference to climate change? What are some things that you're looking at as the changing climate?
I think what's important for, since it's quite early in the game in some sense, in terms of obtaining information and understanding and giving a real voice to indigenous communities at the international level, it's quite important to develop a set of observations and understandings of experiences of indigenous communities with climate change, something that can, let's say, in some ways offset or provide a counterbalance to all of the scientific work that's been ongoing. Because the observations at the very local community level are extremely important for any strategy relating to adaptation. I mean, it's one thing to understand at a global level what is happening in terms of climate, but when it comes to adapting to climate change, it's observations and understandings at the very local level that are extremely important. And for the time being, that's really missing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the internet forum is to, in some ways, connect different local communities, indigenous communities from many different parts of the world, so that they can share their experiences, their observations, different coping strategies that they've traditionally developed, because, of course, changing environments is not something new, and many of the indigenous communities have strategies for dealing with environmental change already, and those can provide a certain basis for the new adaptation strategies that may be needed to face up to climate change.
Mm.
So it's sharing of information, bringing recognition, if you will, to the importance of observations based on indigenous knowledge coming from local communities and bringing recognition of the importance of the local adaptation strategies, these kinds of things that need to be brought to the international level.
Mm-hmm. And when these discussions are going on online, is there records kept of different observations? Is there sort of data collecting going on?
For the time being, the actual forum that is called On the Front Lines of Climate Change has been running since June 2008, so it's relatively recent. And it's a moderated forum in the sense that we receive inputs from anyone who wants to submit observations or comments or concerns relating to climate change can send them in. And then the discussion turns around specific themes. So the initial theme was relating to early impacts from climate change, so trying to solicit observation from communities that are indigenous communities that are experiencing right now the changes that they see as related to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these different inputs and that are put up on a website. And this is climatefrontlines.org is the website that people can consult in order to look at all of the information that has come in so far and look at the different themes that have been discussed over the last few months.
Mm-hmm. What is the ultimate goal of this organization?
I think one of the fundamental motives for establishing this internet forum is, one, to encourage an exchange between local communities in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So if you're, for example, coming from a small island developing state from the Pacific or from the Caribbean or the Indian Ocean, you may be facing similar challenges in relation to climate change. And so exchanging information, experiences, and concerns can be very useful to those communities.
Mm-hmm.
Also to build up, if you will, a kind of collection of observations based on local knowledge about climate change. When it has enough weight, I think can attract attention to the importance of directly involving indigenous peoples in climate change discussions at the international level.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the initiatives that we have now, in fact, last week we just launched a call for proposals where we're giving seed funding to community-level projects in order to encourage local communities or peoples working with local communities to collect directly on the ground information about the types of impacts people are experiencing that they feel are related to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And to begin, in a sense, to develop a kind of a database of information on local observations in relation to climate change, local coping strategies for climate change, these types of information, which are very important to feed from the local level up into the international debate.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to an interview with Douglas Nakashimo of UNESCO on sustainable futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. What is it about indigenous communities that is important as opposed to maybe your more transient communities or your other communities in the world population?
Right. I suppose the things to consider are those communities that are still dependent to a large extent on a livelihood that is rooted in some use of natural resources. Communities, whether they're farming communities or fishing communities or hunting or communities that are dependent on local resources, and because those communities are the ones that will be feeling the effects of climate change most directly,
mm-hmm.
in some ways, because they're already documenting, for example, shifts in wildlife resources moving northwards with the change in climate, for example.
Yeah.
And these types of shifts are going to have direct impacts, whether it's, you know, a mixture of subsistence and partly market and partly subsistence-based livelihoods or resource-based livelihoods of any kind. They will need to develop strategies to adapt to climate change, which is now they're beginning to feel even the last decade or so, but these changes will continue to accelerate, in fact, become much more dramatic in order for them to continue both their way of life and then, of course, related to that, cultural and social aspects of the lives that they choose to live. It'll be important to understand the types of impacts climate change will bring and how to adapt to them.
Mm-hmm. Will your organization or UNESCO be able to help them in some way once enough is gotten through?
We certainly hope so.
Yeah.
I think that it's help at the level of bringing their concerns or strengthening their voice at the international level.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they are the best place to speak for their own issues and for their own concerns and how they want to build their own futures, of course. But it's true that these climate change debates up until now at the international level have been, for the most part, up until now, extremely technical and rather a kind of a closed forum for discussion and exchange for the time being. I think things are changing now, just over the last few years, with recognition of the importance of the issue of adaptation. But there's still a long ways to go in terms of really trying to bring the concerns from the local level up to the global mm-hmm. level of debate. So we do hope that we can help in that process.
Would you say it's been, to this point, focused directly at the governors of countries, the government? Or has there been more of a local debate as well at the world level?
I think at the global level, the debate has been almost exclusively between governments on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
but also, of course, within the scientific community. But within the scientific community at a very high level of expertise, and that it's not a debate that's very accessible to the general public, for one thing. and it's not necessarily dealing at a scale that's relevant for local communities. We're talking about global scale phenomena relating to climate change. That's extremely important to understand. But how do you translate those global scale observations to actual impacts relating to the livelihoods of specific communities on the ground? I think there's still quite a bit of work to be done there. But that is what needs to be done if we are going to be really constructive in terms of helping the civil societies deal with the face up to climate change.
No, I understand how this works now. It's definitely it's bringing the community level of knowledge to this debate that's being government and scientific and whatnot at the world level.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I mean, in the sense that, of course, everyone considers these types of issues like climate change, of course, you know, you need some high-level, high-tech science and all the rest, which is true. You do. It's very useful.
Yeah.
But there's another level of science, if you will, which is rooted in the observation for people who are actually living on the ground and dealing on a day-to-day basis with an environment that's changing. They have observations that they can bring, that they can compare with things that they've seen over the last several decades or that they know from their father's time or grandparents' time. So there is a useful set of data that can come from local communities that are based in local knowledge and that also need to be brought into this whole debate on climate change.
And some indigenous communities may have oral traditions or traditions that go back thousands of years. Have you come across that? Because I'm just imagining that something that goes back that far or even further back in history could have record of dramatic climate change that has happened before.
Yes, I think that, I mean, there are several cases where of indigenous observations, indigenous knowledge, where they have lived through extreme events of many different kinds.
Yeah.
The example that springs to mind is, in fact, not so much related to climate change, but one that may be meaningful for people. When the tsunami hit Southeast Asia, there are indigenous communities that we've been working with in that area, in Thailand. The specific community was the Surin Islanders from the Mokan community in Surin Islands in Andaman Sea. And this community, even though the people living there today had no direct experience with tsunami, what is the tidal wave, the stories of the tidal wave had been passed down from earlier generations. And when they observed the changes on the shoreline of the sea that indicated to them that a tidal wave was coming, they knew immediately to run inland in order to flee the tsunami. And in fact, even though there were something like more than 300,000 people killed on the shorelines of Southeast Asia, the Surin community lost no lives because they knew, not from direct experience, but from what they heard from the previous generation, what was a tsunami and how to react very quickly in order to flee inland and save your lives. And so there were several cases, in fact, of communities in Southeast Asia that did safely escape from the tsunami because they knew from earlier generations what was a tidal wave and how to react appropriately. You know, this knowledge is transferred from generation to generation and, of course, adapted by each generation to changing environmental situations. But this can be extremely useful knowledge that is passed on and can help communities adapt to new situations.
How are you able to reach people from different communities? How do they find out about this organization, the Frontlines of Climate Change Forum? And then how do they always have access to, like, the internet, of course, and things like that? Like, how does this work? How do you reach them?
This is an important point, and I think it's one of the challenges of trying to sort of do the splits between the local level, the very local level, and the international level. Because, of course, the communities that we'd like to really reach out to are rural communities for the most part, and in some parts of the world, communities that don't even have electricity, let alone computers and internet access and the rest. First, we've built up a database of about 40,000 email contacts around the world from all parts of the world that provide sort of the basis, the core of the forum itself. And then we, of course, are getting the word out, encouraging an increasingly broad audience of people to sign up and participate. But the challenge remains in terms of course, we can, since it's an internet-based forum, we can only reach people who have access to internet. We've been looking into some ways to extend the reach then beyond those who have direct access to internet. UNESCO has also a sector for communication and information, and we've been working with the multimedia centers. There are multimedia centers that UNESCO has set up in different parts of the world that facilitate the transfer of information from internet to, for example, local radio,
mm-hmm.
and where there can be a connection made between information that can be downloaded from the internet, transmitted on local radio. People can call in and provide their observations or their information, and then that can be fed back into the internet. These are mechanisms that we're experimenting now with in order to increase the outreach. And, of course, with the call for proposals that we've sent out for small-scale projects at the community level, we're hoping that this will also provide an opportunity to bring observations from the local level, from people who wouldn't necessarily have computers and internet access, to be able to feed into the internet and provide information at the global level.
Mm-hmm.
But it remains a major challenge, that's for sure.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about climate change itself for a while here. What are some things that people are, or the scientists are, anticipating to happen in different regions of the world as the global temperature rises a couple of degrees? What are some things that we might be looking at?
Okay. Well, I must first preface everything I say by saying that I'm not a climate expert myself.
Yeah.
But I think there's quite a bit of information that is out, in fact, to the general public and provided both by the scientific community and from other sources and that. I mean, there's no doubt, I think, that already in the, there are certain environments or habitats, if you will, where accelerated changes due to a changing climate are already having an important impact.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the circumpolar Arctic is one area where, in fact, phenomena of climate change, global warming, is happening, in fact, more dramatically than elsewhere in other parts of the globe. That is, temperature increases and the impacts related to that are accelerated in the high Arctic areas and that. So, of course, I think there have been already considerable documentation of changes in patterns of freeze-up and the melting of ice, which, of course, affects hunting of whether they're the Inuit, Athabascan, or other peoples in the subarctic and the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
They're already seeing important changes in the ice environment, which, of course, is very important and also potentially dangerous, because I think when the ice environment changes, then the knowledge that people have of what ice is safe, for example, to travel on, and which areas of ice are places that are safe for travel or good places for fishing or good places for hunting, these are shifting and changing. And
right.
So this is
and very fast, too.
Yeah. And the same thing is happening in high-altitude areas. In the Andes, the melting out of glaciers, which are an important source of water for irrigating fields in the Andes or in the African context as well. So changes relating to diminishing snow fields and glacier stored water in the form of glaciers is changing the hydrological cycle, and this has consequences for agricultural communities, montane areas around the world.
Mm-hmm.
The other obvious issue is the issue of sea level rise.
Yeah,
where the melting of both of glaciers, more importantly of the Arctic and Antarctic permanent ice, will be contributing increasingly to rising sea levels, which will have very important impacts on small islands and other low-lying areas. And I think, well, the other obvious issues that has come up is changes in the number of extreme climatic events, meteorological events, and that have become less predictable. And
so a lot of how to prepare for a major storm.
Exactly. This is, you know, these types of things are already being observed by many peoples around the world,
mm-hmm.
and they're trying to cope with them already. So it will only accelerate in the future.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to add here in the interview today?
Well, the only thing I'd like to say is that, of course, we'd like to urge any of your listeners who are interested in the issues of climate change and this, the intersection between climate change and the impacts on local communities, that we'd really welcome them to visit the website, which is www.climatefrontlines.org.
Mm-hmm.
Visit the website and see some of the discussions that have been ongoing in the past, see the postings that have come in from around the world on issues relating to local communities and climate change. And also, if people are interested We do have this call for proposals out for small community-level projects. We provide small funding to try and help communities collect local observations and express local concerns, or it could be video projects, or, you know, there are many different options in terms of proposals that we'd be interested to see that we'd like to encourage from the local level. That information can also be downloaded from the website. So we certainly encourage people to contribute, to participate, and to help strengthen the voice of local communities in the global debate on climate change.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us here today.
Well, thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
I've been speaking with Douglas Nakashimo of UNESCO's Frontlines of Climate Change Forum. UNESCO is UNESCO, Frontlines of Climate Change Forum, climatefrontlines.org. Thank you very much, and stay tuned on Sustainable Futures. So this concludes this episode of Sustainable Futures. This is episode number 33. If you would like to get audio copies of this or previous episodes of Sustainable Futures, visit the website www.radioforall.net. I hope you had a good time listening to the interviews today. I am Ryan Fletcher, and Sustainable Futures is every Friday from 3 to 4 p.m. Hope all is going well, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.